Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we're fortunate that Ajahn Kuslo and Venerable Atilo and Tina and others have created this weekend for us to sit and walk and sit. It's a young monastery, so there's always so much to do that it's good to stop. But there is so much to do. One of our big issues right now is storage. Just keep getting books and electronic stuff, and so you'd think we'd be poor and we have nothing, but it's such a wealthy society and there's so many things and people give us things that it can get a bit overwhelming. So we're very fortunate to have that kind of, be involved in that kind of gratitude and that kind of what Venerable Tanisro calls an economy of gifts, where we all try to give to this place, give to the practice in this way of open-heartedness, and that's a rare opportunity in the world, isn't it? In the world of competition or on the whole business, so that to come to a place like this and bring forth a sense of gratitude and goodness. Is very helpful for the practice, isn't it? Gratitude is such a fundamental attitude to liberation, because it's going right against the stream of craving. And the stream of craving is always that energy in mind which is never satisfied. It always wants more, it wants to get rid of it, it wants different. It judges, it does all kinds of things to keep our minds restless and busy and full of suffering. And then when you think about gratitude, that one just to make that conscious and to just hold that sense of gratitude, not as a sort of obligation. You must feel grateful, because that's not gratitude. That's a kind of tyranny. You should feel grateful. That's not gratitude. It's a natural response to goodness. But to learn how to hold that, feel that, know that. And if you really notice it, there's no craving in that. And I feel grateful for all the work that is done here. I come here. I can have a judgmental mind and critical mind and so on. That's one part. But that part which is just so grateful for this, that's a very peaceful part of the mind, isn't it? It's a nice space to abide in. And it's not super duper meditation. It's very ordinary. Gratitude is very, very ordinary. And to make it conscious, to make it strong, and to reflect that there is no craving in gratitude. I feel grateful. I'm not demanding that things be different. So learning to abide in those spaces of consciousness which are liberating. Liberating in the sense of not being, not engaging the craving mind. When we talk about in liberation in Theravada Buddhism, there's usually two streams of analogy that we consider. One is the Nibbana or Nirvana and Nirodha, and the other is Bodhi, deathless, uncreated, unoriginated, unformed. So the Nibbana, Nirvana, Nirodha side of the equation is kind of the emotional way of describing the liberated heart. So that side of the equation talks about the ceasing of craving, or the abandonment of craving, or the burning out, or the blowing out, or the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the other side of the stream of analogy is Bodhi, which is more the Gnostic side. Gnosis is like realization, realize the unconditioned. And the entry to that realization is through mindfulness or awareness. So what prevents mindfulness and awareness is getting caught up with our sense experience. So as we're sitting here and trying to sustain this sense of presence and awareness and openness and clarity, what do we find is that our attention gets somehow distorted or taken up by, kidnapped, hoodwinked by energy forms, dullness, restlessness, by thoughts and worries, plans. And so that clarity is lost, isn't it? And where that clarity gets lost is in greed, hatred, and delusion, as a kind of a simple way of talking about it, or in craving. And that being lost in thought, in sense experience, is what we're trying to liberate the heart from. So the way of Nirodha or Nibbana is the way of abandoning or letting go, not believing in, not attaching. And that's the task of this weekend, or this sitting, or this afternoon, the walking meditation, is to first and foremost establish presence. Simple enough. And, you know, you don't have to be an arahant for that one. Very simple. And then why? A good question to observe, and we can observe ourselves through a question. I find that very helpful. I can bring up a question into consciousness and use that as my way of observation. Not just thinking it, but observing. For instance, like yesterday at the Quaker meeting, there was someone in the audience who I see now once a year, who works out of Africa with an NGO doctor, and inevitably I forget the name, and I meet so many people, and I know the person very well. So then I noticed the person in the back of the room, and I thought, what's the person's name? Couldn't remember. So then I thought, well, okay, well, I'll make that the object of my attention, as well as what I was doing heart practice in the guided meditation. But I thought, I'll just observe how I remember a name. It's quite interesting. Rather than, well, you have to meditate now or have to remember her name, I just made that question. So then I'm talking about how you can use a question to develop mindfulness. So I said, okay, I wonder how the mind will remember this. So I was sitting there describing the heart meditation, and then my mind would throw up. Back to the meditation. And then mind just throw it up. Then it wanted to go do the alphabet. A, B, A, C, no, A, D, no, quiet, back to the heart. And then somewhere, about three quarters through the meditation, there was the name. There's really kind of no idea why that came. Well, not really, it's just, boop, oh yeah. But what I'm pointing there is not just how you remember names, but that you can, you know, when you ask a question, and it's not simply to engage the analytical mind, but it's to engage the observing mind, that can be very helpful. So in meditation, the kind of question you might ask is like, so what, first of all, you have to kind of have confidence and trust and faith in this sense of presence. You know, that understanding that and feeling that that's really where it's at, this awake mind, that's really where it's at, is tremendously helpful, because then you've got a basis of trust in what you're working with or what you're working towards to remember that. If you don't have that, then you tend to always try to be getting something, you know, becoming a better person, getting rid of your anger, being this and being that. So there's a kind of sense of a self, an ego, becoming something. But notice that, like, the sense of presence and awakeness, there's no real sense of a person doing it. It's just the open mind, freed from all the clutter of becoming and self and ego and fear and that. So trusting in that, to me, is terribly important and a basis for this life, this practice. And then, so the question, in terms of like popping a question, so what takes this away? What is it? What kind of thoughts or moods grab the attention? How does kidnapping take place? And then having popped a question in, and that's what we're doing when we're reflecting. That's what the reflective mind is. You pop that question and you let go of thought and you observe. Or maybe you're feeling dull, kind of post-lunch meditation. It's a terrible time to meditate, by the way. And you're kind of full and just naughty. Then you ask a question. Well, how does dullness arise? So first of all, you have to establish clarity. So you forget about your object of meditation. You look, like if you're sleepy, you just look around. They're all nodding too. And then, but you're clear. You're not there judging everyone. And there's clarity. And then the question is, so how does dullness come into the body? Or where is dullness first felt in the body? So within this hindrance of dullness, you're now introducing some kind of energy, brightness, and that we call Dhamma Vijaya. Investigation of Dhamma. Dhamma not in terms of just concepts, but the Dharma of this process which I'm now experiencing. So then you find that sometimes you really have to work very diligently with a particular mood of the mind. It might be very, very strong. You know, you really have to work at it because it's so powerful and so strong. So like dullness is a very gross kind of energy, isn't it? It just kind of keeps knocking you out. And so then you maybe have to use quite coarse kind of energy. So you try, what if I use a really coarse kind of energy now? I just keep my eyes open. How does that work? So you're not just forcing out the hindrance, but you're actually engaging the hindrance in experimental ways. And work with it. And over time, then you know how to be with that particular hindrance when it comes up, all the hindrances that come up. And then sometimes, of course, you don't need much effort. And your mind has brightness, and it's pretty calm. There hasn't been a lot of stress in the last week, and you've had a good rest, and whatever, and the mind doesn't need much effort. You know, it's just very, you can just relax it. Just be really open, and make very little effort. And then you can make just little subtle suggestions. Don't touch it. Don't go anywhere. Something very, very subtle. And so it rather depends. It rather depends on the energy system you're experiencing right now, what happened in the family at work last week, and whatever, all kinds of things like that. But I think the real nub of it is the sense of being a contemplative practitioner rather than just a willful practitioner, just willfully trying to annihilate, get rid of, to become, never really works because it's not conjoined with wisdom. Wisdom is that reflective quality which understands cause and effect, which understands when, with dullness as condition, if I put this kind of effort forth, the dullness doesn't overwhelm me. But you have to do the homework, and quite often the homework is not nice, not pleasant. And you just feel restless, and you don't want to really do the work. But that's really important to meditate then. So on a small, like day of mindfulness or a retreat, you find you're just kind of The beauty of it is you're just with the posture. You're with the body, you're with the walking, sitting, walking. You're with these people in this room. So let's say it's quite crowded in there, right? You might be stuffy, person beside you might be shifting around a lot, might be breathing much too loud and it's good for them, or whatever. And then that's the practice, isn't it? It's the posture. This is the way things are. And then maybe there's a sense it's much more peaceful at home. It'd be much rather nicer in my home. And then that's the mindset that comes up. Where, how does awareness get kidnapped by that? Wanting things to be other than they are. So you always have this lovely quality of Dhamma Vijaya investigating, but it's not just thinking. It's much, much more profound than thinking. It's watching, observing, but with a particular tone and with a particular avenue of approach, and that is how to liberate the heart from suffering, how to sustain the awareness as things come and go. Now imagine if you can sustain this kind of awake awareness. If you can sustain it for one in-breath, two in-breaths, for a whole hour, the power that begins to generate in consciousness is quite significant. So in the beginning, quite often we're working with the sort of nirodha, the emotional side of this these analogies, where we're we're sometimes just like struggling with fears or dullness or whatever. And then as we learn about those parts, the rough emotions and so on, we have more and more capacity to just like contemplate, just be aware without doing anything. And we call that choiceless awareness. So you're not trying to do anything. You're just being, ease of being, non-becoming, this kind of language. And to sustain that, obviously you need a certain kind of basis of samadhi or a basis of clarity and stillness. But that's important. That's really important. Last night I was describing a mood that came through my mind on Thursday, and it was a very, very, very heavy kind of negative, not depressed, that's too strong a word, but very heavy, too much rain and too much being stuck in a condo and probably too much time developing a curriculum for some Buddhist stuff, too much time intellectually, right? So whatever the factors were, this mood kept on arising and wanting to go into negativity, whining, complaining, kind of pathetic, feeling sorry for myself kind of stuff. And there, that's a kind of an example of like a very coarse kind of thing going on. It's very strong. So then do some yoga, stand on the head, or go for a walk, or just sit and watch it, observe it. Where is it? Where is it now? Well, how does it arise? What kind of thoughts arise there? And that was like a whole day of this very, very, very heavy, unpleasant kind of a mood. In the teachings about Nirodha and Nibbana, what we're like Nirodha is the abandonment of craving, the cessation of craving, the letting go of craving. So in this case, what's the problem? Is it the mood? Well, the mood is negative, the mood is unpleasant, but the real problem is somehow why I don't want it. I don't want it there. It's unpleasant. I want to get rid of it. Naturally enough, no one likes that. And seeing that the mood is the mood because of certain conditions, but the wanting to get rid of it, not wanting it, wanting to distract or do something else. Again, unfortunately, I can't really do much else. I don't have the resources to do much else. You decide to do yoga, you look at your mind or whatever, and just kind of taking something quite unpleasant like that as the object of meditation. Not just to think that meditation is always just some kind of ethereal opening of the heart and the calmness of watching the breath, that meditation or the practice of awakened consciousness, it's very important to apply that to very, very unpleasant, difficult, and negative states of mind, say, in this case. So then they're just sitting and being, okay, let it come up. What is it? What's the problem? And then it's just a mood. You see, it's just a mood. It's just that way. And then the mind wants to take that. If perception and thought, the perception creates the world. The mood comes up, and then the perception colors everything. Colors my mother, colors the flat, colors, it's just like a world being created through a mood. But when you go back to the mood itself, it's just a mood. It feels this way. And then the thoughts start to pick it up. And then there's just the mood. And then the thoughts start to pick it up. And you're going to watch that pattern. And you begin to be able to more and more and more skillfully just, no, it's just, this is the mood is this way. So the mind kind of awakens to something which is been maybe habitually distracted, blame, whatever, gone into thought. And that's how you get the strength of awareness through those kinds of things. And then that strength of awareness that you develop through, then that starts to play itself out when there isn't that kind of a maybe coarse kind of a mood where there isn't anything really big. And then the mindfulness can be quite strong, and then it just kind of carries itself. It just kind of carries itself because it's been established and developed and grounded in consciousness now. So consciousness isn't just overwhelmed by moods and opinions and thoughts, but all that energy of thought has been now countered through awareness, through awareness, through awareness practice. So the awareness becomes a more major factor in the way your mind works. Right? The mind now is more and more embedded in awareness as a natural kind of way of being, not just a willful thing, because the energy has been put into that, the intentions have been put into that. And then that begins to carry in the more subtle kinds of meditations, when you can be with things like choiceless awareness. And then you pick that up, and then you just decide, just choiceless, just don't touch it, don't go anywhere, nothing to do. Now, if you just say there's nothing to do as an absolute, then it's ridiculous, right? Buddhism is don't do anything. It's ridiculous. You still have to go to the toilet. You have to take care of your mother. You have to feed yourself. So sometimes New Age ways of talking about, like, it's all perfect. You know, we're all one, all very well and good. But these words have meaning in time and place. So if, you know, an important thing to contemplate in your own meditations, when you feel fairly at ease and so on, don't pick up on object of meditation. Try doing nothing. Right? Don't always feel, I have to meditate. Because sometimes that kind of, I have to meditate to get something, is this sense of always having to manufacture something or produce something or get a result, which is still very much embedded in the craving mind. I am someone who is inadequate, and I need to do these things in order to become fulfilled. Right? And you can bring that into the spiritual life. But fulfillment is not something that happens in the future. It's something that opens in the present moment, always. And the only problem is that the habits, the negative habits, or just the habits of heedlessness, prevent that clarity from being sustained for long periods of time. So if you know, one of the recommendations is to pick up an object of meditation and do it really well. Learn different kinds of meditations. Learn to open a heart. Learn to be with the breath. Learn to be with the body. Develop those very, very useful skills. But then also learn to do nothing. Learn just be. Just establish awareness and just abide as that. And then see what happens. See what happens. Then, quite often, you notice how there's a sort of willfulness to get something or be something or become something. And that reflection becomes more and more subtle. More and more subtle. You see how will and self and becoming are really one part, just one piece which needs to be let go of for bodhi, for enlightenment. So sometimes it's like you're riding a bicycle, right? It's over rough terrain, you really got to hold on to the bicycle. You've got a mountain bike and you're going through but sometimes you're on a really smooth path and you can just take your hands off the handlebars. It sort of depends. But the skillful contemplative or the skillful meditator has that capacity for investigation. That's really important. The capacity to observe cause and effect, try things out, not according to some prescribed way that you have to, like metta practice. Say that the way it's described as you do a friend, then you do a relative, then you do a neutral person, then you do an enemy, you do yourself somewhere in there too. Right? And then, you know, this kind of very prescribed package that when you read about it, that we get, and then you do groups, and then you do it. So I've never been able to do that. I always try to, it always seems so mechanical. But then, wait a minute, how would I do this? What would work for me? And then what works for me is the way I describe it. I remember through my emotional side, I remember someone that I'm close to. So I remember my mother. And then that memory triggers an emotional response of closeness and friendship, amity. I get a feeling for that. And I generate it, the one person, another person. And that's enough. And then I just live with the open heart. Now that works for me. But when I first read this description of Sudhimagga, and then I tried it, I was like, I'm just thinking all the time here. But then I read the book from Sharon Spoke, where she's not thinking, she's actually blissed out. So then you can feel, you know, like I felt, like totally useless, inadequate. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. I mean, I'm not totally black-hearted. You know, I've got to know, but how do I get to that? And what I'm just trying to point out is that each of us has an individual kind of set of circumstances we're dealing with, familial, emotional, historical, right? And the basic principles of calming the mind, opening the part. These are obvious, aren't they? But how do we do that? You know, how do we do that? Well, we do that partially by noticing how we get overwhelmed. When the heart's open, when it's closed. When the mind's calm, when it's confused. When you get overwhelmed with thought, when you're free from thought. And then seeing how each of us operates, we begin to have an intuition of what works for us. not because it's been a prescribed technique, but because we've had the trust in our own capacity to see cause and effect, the skillfulness to try things out rather than just judge them, the determination to try something for a longer period of time. Like any kind of a practice which you do, you can't expect the result in a week. You know, if you pick up metta practice, if you've never done practice of the heart, and you expect some great result, you might, like the first sitting sometimes people do and then you don't. These things take time, like body awareness. I was saying last night that when I started in the monastery, I didn't have very, very good body awareness. You know, I played sport, so I could push the body, or when the body was filled with some excitement or pain, I could be aware of it. But it's just to be conscious of the body's energies, to be conscious of the heart center, to be conscious of how the body feels in different ways. That quite often takes time. You have to keep returning to that, returning to understand it, returning to let it kind of speak for itself. So determination, the willingness to really to kind of stick with something and do it is a huge factor. So like on a retreat, we have periods of meditation. We have 45 minutes, which isn't very long. So when you're doing walking, like if you do walking meditation, stay for the 45 minutes. Not a big thing, because quite often I notice on retreats, people after 20 minutes go have a cup of tea. Like, well, that's not much determination, right? And that ability to kind of like take a session and really, really make a determination to stay with that session, the whole 45-minute sitting, or the whole 45-minute walking, and then watch within that. So you start, like, usually what happens is you do some sitting now, your legs are probably killing you, you want to go for a walk, finally I ring the bell, you can get out, yeah, oh, this is nice, it's pleasant. Then you walk back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and then of course after 20 minutes you're bored. And then if you're bored, then you start to look around, and then you think, well, time for tea. You go have a cup of tea. That Ajahn Chah called that practicing with disaster. Because you're basically just following your whims, aren't you? It's nice, it's pleasant, but the most important part is probably the second half of the walking when you're bored. You know, yeah, I'm not getting anywhere. Like walking meditation, many people think, oh, that's not really... We were talking about that, I think. I was talking with a friend about that. It's not really the real stuff. You know, the real stuff is like full lotus and getting the old chakras blown away and so on. But actually, to talk about mindfulness of walking is very fruitful. It's very fruitful just to be able to just be mindful in a very ordinary posture. And then if you're investigating, if the task is to sustain this awake mind, and you put a boundary on that, on the time, you know, you put a boundary of 45 minutes, you have the boundary of space, walking meditation, you mark the path, one end and the other end, and that's your container. And that's very important, to kind of stay in the container. And then within the container, you start to have desire. You know, desire comes to do something else. Now, it's not immoral. You can do something else and no one's going to chuck you out. But to actually notice that desire, so after 20 minutes you want to do something else, you know, so this is the feeling of wanting to do something else. And that's the investigative mind. It's looking now. It's observing, oh, yeah. And then you go to the end and the mind starts to want to think about, it wants to do something else, so then starts to plan tomorrow, right? And you go to the end of the path, you stop planning. Let go. Turn around. And then the mind starts to think, well, you're going to go shopping, and then stop. Shopping. And then you walk, and then, God, I want to have a cup of tea. Stop. So each time you're awakening to this tendency to become, and then you begin to address the mind, which is restless. So how else would you address restlessness? You wouldn't address it by just following the restless mind. So by creating a container, 45 minutes, and walking back and forth, you begin to see the mind which wants to do something else, basically. And because it's not harmful, it's not, I mean, if it starts to snow and rain and so on, you know, no problem. But it's not harmful. It's just a restless mind, bored, wants to do something else. And if I never notice that, and I just do something else, and something else, and something else, then I can never realize enlightenment, because my mind is always distracted by sense experience. But if I begin to see that, like, the wanting to do something else is an object of awareness, wanting to be somewhere else, wanting someone else to be different is an object of awareness, then the mind begins to have samadhi, begins to have calm over that. And so if you add that up in a couple of days of meditation, then that those are the factors which create calm. Not because you've willfully done it, because you've just practiced awareness around different kinds of mindsets. So the container is very helpful. That's how we function in monastic life. We have these, like the container I have now with my mother is that I'm sort of a quasi-nurse companion, but my major discipline is monasticism. So I'm very contained. I don't have money, I don't have a car, and my umbrella broke. Fortunately, my brother got me a new umbrella, but I was feeling pretty dire. I couldn't, it was raining all the time, my umbrella's broken. If I had money in a car, just jump, go for a drive, go to the cinema, and get an umbrella. But no, you haven't got an umbrella. So I emailed my brother, please get me an umbrella. And he got me one 3 days later. So I want to go for a walk, can't go for a walk. So the mind's restless. Now this is the way it is now. This is life without an umbrella. This is life without a car and money. Now I'm being facetious. It was pretty serious there. But the container like forced me just to look at a restless mind, a kind of negative kind of mind. Is your only choice for Dhammo is here. You sort it out here, and you'll get an umbrella later. But it was a very good lesson. Yeah, really kind of a throwback to sort of adolescent state of mind or whatever. It used to be a very heavy kind of adolescent. And just a throwback to some old mindset, which the factors were there and it came up. And just to kind of just, no, it's all right. You got to work it out here. This is what it feels like. And then sitting and watching and observing and serving mom and then watching and so on. And then it ceases. And that's a very fruitful kind of experience. Having said that, if I had an umbrella, I would have gone for a walk. So containment, it can be very, very useful in that way. And that's what our monastic sort of way of living is kind of forcing us to look at things. And so in a way, like a little 2-day session like this, or even if you only have an afternoon, it's like setting up a kind of monastic situation for lay people where you have the limits of what you can do, and then you watch yourself within those limits. So the noble silence is very helpful for that. Say, like if you're a very, very quiet person, it's easy, but if you're a talkative person, it takes more effort. But the effort then is to notice a habit of wanting to talk all the time and say, oh, this is the habit of wanting to talk. And then the person that talks a lot thinks the rule doesn't apply to them for some reason. And they talk. But when you take on a discipline, this is for me. This isn't for the other guys. This is about me. So noble silence is part of the container. So then, and then maybe you feel awkward not talking around the meal. Oh, this is awkwardness. Awkwardness feels this way. Or you want to say something really important. This is a feeling wanting to say something really important. So all the time you're just awakening, rather than being impulsive or compulsive or habitual in all our actions and transactions and so on. And then you can see if you cultivate in that way for long periods of time, mindfulness gets really, really strong. And then you can see from that strong mindfulness, bodhi is possible. The unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, because the mind begins to abide as awareness. And that's the gateway or the opening to that Gnostic side realization. All right? That's a whole bunch of stuff to think about. I'll leave it there.
Namagataya sadhu karanga damasi.